From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Some Florida lawmakers and the governor really want to cut or even do away with the state's property taxes. But are they shooting in the dark?
How much money that brings into local governments to fund essential services, we don't know.
Also this week, with so many critical issues facing state lawmakers, you might think culture war stuff might be taking a back seat this session, and you'd be wrong.
Our society is over this. They want to move past it so we can move back together again.
We'll also get the latest on Florida's population and migration trends, along with an inside look at the intense legislative debates over the matter of what fine feathered friend should be the state bird. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
Governor Ron DeSantis's fight to end property taxes in Florida has dominated much of the conversation during this legislative session. Lawmakers continue to discuss how to eliminate these funds without impacting programs and services. FGCU political science professor Sandra Pavelka joined WGCU's John Davis and Jennifer Crawford to talk about the property tax issue and more.
Governor Ron DeSantis' priority of reducing or eliminating homestead property taxes was really expected to take center stage during this session. Can you give us an update on this measure?
Well, it certainly has been taking center stage. You may recall there were a number of House proposals that had been brought forth before session started. One advanced through the House Ways and Means Committee. This was the proposal that would incrementally increase the homestead tax exemption over the course of a decade until non-school property taxes will be eliminated in 2037. We also saw housemakers hold a press conference criticizing how much air in the room this issue was taking up, saying it's dominating session and taking away interest from other important issues.
They have not really moved on it in the Senate. It still has to move through the House for a full, complete House vote for a supermajority, by the way, John, right? Where this session, the House has to vote, because it has to do with property taxes, at 60%, a supermajority. Then it would go to the Senate for a Senate vote of 60%, really a comparable bill. And then it would have to go to the governor, who says he would support it, and ultimately to the voters, which would also have to be a supermajority because it has to do with our taxes. However, this is not a priority for most of the voters in our state.
Right. A new Florida Policy Institute study finds that most Florida voters find the cost of property insurance a much higher priority than property taxes. I still have a great deal of concern about this because the Florida Department of Economic and Demographic Research has still not released a study about the feasibility of eliminating property taxes in terms of how much money that brings into local governments to fund essential services. We don't know where that funding would be made up in any of these proposals. And the governor himself, having been touting this since last February, has not put forth any sort of policy proposal himself.
Well, let's move on to our Senate President, Ben Albritton, really pushing this rural renaissance legislative package. Can you explain what that is and what the status is?
Just a little background. Florida Senate President Albritton is from Bartow, and that's primarily a rural area. He also is, I think, a fourth generation
citrus grower.
Grower and farmer. So this is really important. This is actually part of his legacy as he leaves the Senate. This is something that he worked on last year. It didn't really go anywhere. And this year, they're looking to really move it through both the Senate and the House. It includes four specific provisions. One is for economic development. One is for infrastructure, education, and healthcare. So each of those has components within it. It's passed the Senate, but hasn't really gained any momentum in the House. So we'll have to see where it goes. The other thing is DeSantis said he would support it. So it would be interesting to see what the House does with this bill.
And the impact of agriculture in the state of Florida.
Huge.
This would have a huge impact.
Absolutely. It's a $152 million appropriations bill. The economic impact is about $240 million. This is incredible. The agricultural industry, which includes citrus, sugar cane, et cetera.
Chattel, right.
Is $8.8 billion in the state of Florida. So this can only help a very struggling farming community at this point.
And we thank our partners at WGCU for that reporting. We have reached the halfway point in the 2026 Florida legislative session, and still so much undone. You know, Florida's legislature has actually been attracting an awful lot of attention across the country over the past several years, especially by waging culture wars against things like DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, and some other things as well. But that hasn't stopped this legislative session. It continues, and Tristan Wood, our Capitol reporter, has been following some of the bills that have been proposed along that vein, some of which are gaining steam this session. Tristan, what's been happening there?
So there are a host of these culture war-type bills, but I've been following two very closely. Probably the most impactful one is going to be House Bill 1001, which passed its second committee this week. It would force local governments to shutter offices and programs focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's a continuation that, like you alluded to, the years-long effort by Republicans in Florida, led by Governor Ron DeSantis, to go after DEI programs across different public institutions.
Okay, so let's get specific here. What exactly would go away under that bill?
So it models a lot of the restrictions that we've seen passed for higher education and different education levels, but this time for cities and counties. First, it would shutter DEI offices. They typically do diversity training, but they also monitor equity in hiring, essentially checking to see if there aren't slanting their hiring to one gender, race, or other protected group. It would also block minority grant programs. So if a local government has a program for, let's say, to promote minority-owned business growth, they would no longer be able to continue them because it would be giving out money related with race being a determinant. And it would also prevent local funding going to what the bill considers DEI events that are not state holidays. That would likely impact, for one example that was brought up in committee, pride parades or pride events around the state. So if it were to be passed, local governments could not sponsor or give any type of grants or funding to those types of local pride events.
All right. Well, you indicated that there was some conversation during the committee process looking this. What did that conversation sound like?
So Jacksonville Republican Representative Dean Black is this bill's sponsor, and he thinks that this crackdown is something that Floridians want, pointing to his party's dominance in recent elections in the state. The election of Donald Trump, Governor Ron DeSantis winning by around 20 points in 2022, along those lines.
And I realize we don't all agree on the policy. I get that. But collectively, our society is over this, and they want to move past it so we can move back together again.
And now, the bill did get loud opposition from local governments, Democratic lawmakers, and activists. Orlando Democratic Representative Bruce Anton says it weakens the infrastructure watching for workplace discrimination and takes away the ability for local officials to decide ultimately what's best for their specific community.
We're taking away local control. We're taking away control or the option for local government to govern themselves. This bill accomplishes nothing.
You know, despite his criticism, the bill's moving full steam ahead in both the House and the Senate, despite that opposition.
Certainly not the only thing that's going on. What other bill are you watching in this regard?
So the other bill I'm watching closely, House Bill 641, would prohibit public employers and private contractors that receive state funds from requiring their workers use pronouns that don't align with a person's sex assigned at birth. Essentially, if someone in a workplace is transgender and their biological sex is male, but they go by she, her pronouns, the employer that receives state funding, so that could be either like a local municipality, a state government agency, or a private company that receives funds from the government for contracting purposes, they couldn't require their employees to call that person by their preferred pronouns, instead allowing them to call them by the pronouns of the gender that they were assigned at birth. It would also prohibit trainings that involve instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity.
Well, that should have been an interesting discussion in committee, was it?
Yeah, dozens of people came out and spoke against this bill. Opponents said that they worried that it would lead to transgender people being misgendered or harassed in the workplace, basically allowing people to refer to them by the pronouns that they don't prefer. Quinn Diaz, who works with the group Equality Florida, which is an LGBTQ plus advocacy group, was one of those speakers that spoke during committee.
No law lets someone demean a coworker because of race or religion. It should be no different because the person's transgender. Expecting employees to treat coworkers with basic respect is a standard condition of employment, not government-compelled speech.
Seminole Republican Representative Rachel Plaken, who's the bill sponsor, said that it's focused on protecting freedom for people to follow their beliefs, i.e. the freedom of people to say and speak their true beliefs.
It allows individual employees to identify themselves as whatever pronouns they wish and still allows other employees to refer to them by those same pronouns if they want to. What it prohibits is employers enforcing speech codes and ideological viewpoints on employees that violate their religious, conscience, and free speech rights.
Now, much like the other bill, though, this bill is moving forward in both chambers, and it seems like Florida's legislature is headed towards continuing this anti-DEI trend.
We'll keep an eye on it, and I know you will be too, and we'll talk about it more in the weeks to come. Tristan Wood, our Capitol reporter here on Capitol Report. Thanks, Tristan.
No problem, Tom.
Coming up on Capitol Report, the old saying was everybody wants to move to Florida, but maybe the new saying is fewer people now want to move to Florida, and experts say that's not a good thing.
Economic growth is dependent on population growth. There is a direct correlation.
And an effort to make the flamingo the state bird is back, and the discussion this week in the Florida House was rife with puns.
And I know it's going to be successful as everyone has been flocking around your office to support this.
Florida's population is slowing. Tom Hudson reports the state relied on immigration for almost all of its population growth last year.
The flow of new Floridians slowed down a lot in the past year. The torrid population growth the Sunshine State experienced in the years right after the COVID-19 pandemic has given way to...
I would say it's more a normalization.
That's Sheridan Morby. She's a senior research economist at the Florida Chamber Foundation. Now, the state's population grew by more than 500 people a day last year, but that's a sharp slowdown from the last couple of years and the slowest annual growth this decade.
The primary reason for that slowdown is the significant decline in international migration.
That's Maria Elcheva. She is the associate director at the Metropolitan Center at Florida International University. Now, for years, the main contributor to Florida's surging population was people moving here from someplace else in the United States. But that shifted in 2023 when most new Floridians were coming to the Sunshine State from other countries. The slowdown in people moving to Florida comes as the Trump administration launched its immigration enforcement effort. Morby credited changes to the Census Bureau's methodology to much of the swing. The Bureau did update how it estimates how many people move and where within the U.S. they move. It also made adjustments to benchmarks for international migration estimates. In 2024, there were more than 400,000 people from overseas moving to Florida. But by last year, that had dropped to just 178,000 people, a decline of 56%. Ilcheva said the slowdown in international migration was not a surprise because of the immigration enforcement.
But still, the size of that decline and what it means for our long-term economic stability or economic growth certainly raises important questions.
In the year ending in July, Census Bureau data show 9 out of 10 people moving to Florida came from overseas. While the proportion of international migrants jumped, the total number plunged, as did the number of people moving from other states.
We know they're coming from high-cost states like New York, California. We're starting to see Texas and Georgia up there as well in terms of who's migrating into the state.
Florida's population totaled almost 23.5 million people in the latest Census Bureau estimate. That is up about 200,000 people from a year earlier. But without the migration, the state's population would actually be shrinking. You see, Floridians are just not making enough new Floridians, not having enough babies to make up for the number of Floridians dying. That's been the case for at least the past 5 years. It means Florida's population growth has been entirely outsourced to people moving to the state.
Economic growth is dependent on population growth. There is a direct correlation. Your population stops growing, that means less consumptions, less demand for services and goods. There is a negative snowball effect.
When we're talking about migration, population growth, really what matters there is how it's fueling our economy and if our economy can support that growth. And we're seeing that historically it has been supporting that growth.
Some of the slowest growth over the past 4 years has been with important ages for the state's economy, people in their late 20s. That's traditionally an age when people start families and buy their first homes. The state's public and private university system helps attract students in their early 20s, but keeping them after graduation remains a challenge.
What's the pipeline between them seeing Florida as a state where it's valuable to get an education, and then do they stay here and work here? And a lot of that is the connection between the degrees, the education they're getting, and the jobs that are available. So making that connection.
Florida's cost of living also is playing a role here. The state's population of people in their late 50s actually declined between 2020 and 2024. But while folks approaching retirement may be leaving, retirees continue flocking here. The fastest growing group of new Floridians is those over 75 years old.
That creates challenges for healthcare systems that may not necessarily be adapted for that big influx that they're experiencing now.
Now, the last time Florida's population actually got smaller, that was back in 1946, the year after World War II ended, and large numbers of military servicemen and women left the state. I'm Tom Hudson.
As the federal government continues efforts against illegal immigration, the Department of Homeland Security reports nearly 1.9 million people have agreed to self-deport over the past year. Individuals are choosing to depart on their own in order to avoid being arrested, which could lead to bans on their possible re-entry back into the U.S. Elizabeth Andarji spoke to a woman who's choosing to take her family back to Central America following her husband's detainment by Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Pues por el momento, ahorita yo...
We don't know how their future is going to be. We're going back to our country, and we will have to figure it out once we're there.
Ariana is shopping for her children, but not for a birthday or a holiday present. These toys are for the journey back to Guatemala. Back because Ariana and her two kids are self-deporting. 2 weeks ago, ICE detained Ariana's husband. Within a week, he was deported.
Pues todo estaba bien porque él...
He was an excellent husband. After work, he would come and he would play with the kids, and they had a good time. And also, when I became sick, he would take care of me as well.
Ariana says she struggled as the sole breadwinner and caretaker. She talked about her decision to leave the U.S. and self-deport to Guatemala.
Que los niños...
I'm doing this for the children because the children need their father. I'm doing this because they need him emotionally. I'm doing this for the family.
When it came to the impending trip, that's when Ariana's children started asking questions. She told them a partial truth. They're going to Guatemala for vacation.
And then they asked, if daddy is working, how come he left the phone home? That's strange.
Voices of Bonita is a grassroots organization, and when it started hearing stories like Ariana's, it launched an emergency grant program.
In that type of situation, any support, emotional, economically support, it's very much welcome. So I felt grateful.
As soon as someone loses a breadwinner because of a deportation, they need immediate money right away. So why don't we just get them $100 right in their hands so they can pay rent, buy food.
Ajpal Colleen Mesa is the co-founder of Voices of Bonita. He founded it in July of 2025 and says the organization has plans to lend a helping hand and push forward for those going through the immigration process.
I would really like the community to know that we really just care about our neighbors, that we really don't see the person next to us as an immigrant or a citizen. They're just a neighbor in need. And we want to kind of cushion some of the challenges that they're facing and give them hope and let them know that there is some decency and humanity left in their immediate streets.
I'm Elizabeth Andarji.
During disasters, we see first responders run toward emergencies. Other responders, who are almost always invisible to us, work side by side with the heroes we do see. WGCU's Bryant Monte introduces us to a collection of individuals who feel the work they provide is a calling from a higher power.
The work of a chaplain often comes during life's most crucial and traumatic times. Now, their mission is to provide that spiritual and emotional support during those critical moments.
Being there for them, to support them, to hear them, to encourage them is the role that I play as a chaplain.
Ricky Anderson has served as a chaplain for law enforcement in Southwest Florida for more than two decades.
Just being there for them is most important.
He's been there for those first responders who see and experience traumatic situations.
What I think shook up people was the number of deaths after Ian, because never experienced that many deaths. And I remember hearing one of the deputies talk about how he tried to save this man and woman. He was able to save the woman, but wasn't able to save the man. Now, he got to live with that the rest of his life, you know, because you're trying to do what you feel is best, and then you kind of like feel like you failed. So my role at that point is to help that deputy understand you've done what you could do, and when it's beyond your control, there's nothing you can do. It's a servant position where I'm with families, doing funerals, when there's a homicide, being called out, being there with the family. That's ministering to those people.
Instead of ministering from the pulpit, like Adelar Garcia from CEMA, which stands for Chaplain Emergency Management Agency.
In Florida, we have a disaster. Every year we have a hurricane, and people need support in emotional and in spiritual. And this is what we do. I think the most important is emotional support, because when the people lost your house and needed support for emotional. I love to do this job because this job gives me something special. I think it's something from God. When I help somebody, I'm not waiting for somebody to pay for this job. I receive it from God.
It's a beautiful ministry. And because you deal with situation that the person been going through.
Chaplains often serve without being paid. Instead, like Israel Suarez, chaplain for the Fort Myers Police Department, they seek a higher calling and what money cannot buy.
I'm not here for the money. I'm here because it's my moral and spiritual, and I follow Jesus' philosophy, social and spiritual.
Chaplains are a part of our military, local and federal governments, law enforcement agencies, hospitals, prisons, and schools. They're referred to as a minister in the workforce, providing spiritual support to people from various backgrounds and beliefs.
Sometimes we have to get in the trenches, and that's what I believe that I need to do, and I've done that. I don't get paid for what I do. You know, church take care of me, so I just do this as a servant, because Jesus says, I came not to be served, but to serve. So that's what I do. I just serve. I feel good on the inside knowing that I was able to help somebody.
Chaplains, a calling, a service, a way to help and minister to those who experience firsthand tragedy and loss. I'm Bryant Monte.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, lawmakers are trying again to designate the flamingo as the official state bird and the Florida scrub jay as the state songbird. While the bill's fate is uncertain in the Senate, Gina Jordan reports it breezed through the full House this week.
The mockingbird's been around for 97 years. I saw one in Pennsylvania. I thought it was lost.
The mockingbird has been Florida's state bird for nearly a century. Isla Mirada Republican Representative Jim Mooney thinks it's the flamingo's turn.
This is an environmental bill for me. I live in one of the most pristine places in the state of Florida, in the Florida Keys, And they're there. They're there by the hundreds now. The scrub jays from Okeechobee North, they're the coolest little birds. And the more I learned about them, the cooler they became. To come back 5 years later and take care of their little brothers and sisters, that in and of itself is amazing.
During discussion of the bill on the House floor, Hialeah Republican Representative Alex Rizzo took the opportunity for puns.
Representative Mooney, I know you've been waiting a long time for this bill, and I know it's going to be successful as everyone has been flocking around your office to support this.
Flamingos have had a rough go of it. Many were slaughtered, and the species nearly became extinct in the early 1900s. But a growing number have been spotted in Florida in recent decades, and a scientist at Florida International University says coastal and Everglades restoration is leading more flamingos to take up permanent residence here. Plus, hundreds of them were blown into the Sunshine State from areas well to the west and south of us during recent hurricane seasons. St. Petersburg Republican Representative Linda Cheney offered an example from Hurricane Idalia.
Peaches, the flamingo, was blown to my district and rescued by my former aide, Tristan. Peaches' little nose was just barely sticking above the water, and Tristan saw her and scooped her out of the water. She's been rehabilitated.
Supporters say the hardy flamingo is worthy of the state bird title, and they've been trying to make this change for 5 years. Some lawmakers even dressed in pink for the bill's passage, like St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Lindsey Cross.
We are seeing a comeback demonstrating the importance of our state and federal investments and showing that they are making a difference. For me, I'm even more proud to designate the Florida scrub jay as our state songbird. This curious and charismatic bird is only found in Florida. Like many birds and wildlife, its population has declined due to habitat loss and fragmentation. But recognizing this bird can symbolize a commitment to save its species and its home like we do for the things we love.
One of the lawmakers behind this year's bird bill is Broward County Republican Representative Chip LaMarca. He says Florida shouldn't share its state bird with four other southern states, as we do now with the mockingbird.
So let's close this chapter of legislative bird watching. Florida won't just be the sunshine state, it'll be the fantastic flamingo state. And if that doesn't make the mockingbird rethink its life choices, at least the flamingo will look fabulous doing it. Let's make flamingos great again.
The vote was 112 to 1.
The clerk will lock the machine.
Those boos are for Pensacola Republican Representative Alex Andrade, the single no vote. He has said he wants the pelican as the state bird. The bill now awaits action in the Senate. I'm Gina Jordan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to John Davis, Jennifer Crawford, Elizabeth Andarji, and Brian Monte. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from T.C. McGuire, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.